Welcome to Dakota Midday. I'm Lori Walsh. Seth Tupper is an enterprise reporter at the Rapid City Journal. Dana Ferguson is a watchdog state government and political reporter for the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. Today, we welcome them as our Dakota political junkies. Seth, welcome back to Dakota Midday.
Thanks for having me.
Dana, thanks for being here as well.
Thank you for having me.
Seth, let's start over with you, and let's start right off with Harney Peak, Black Elk Peak. And what's the latest on that? You've been writing about this, or the Journal has been covering it, for quite some time.
Yeah, for us, it started when a guy came into our office in late 2014 and said he wanted to talk about a story, and it turned out to be Basil Bravehart telling us that he wanted to formally propose a name change for Harney Peak. And fast forward 2 years, and here we are at a place where not many, if any, would have predicted that the federal government the federal government's U.S. Board on Geographic Names would vote to change the name to Black Elk Peak. As far as the latest, I've been trying to track developments with the governor's office. The state is not, as many people may know by now, the state is not in any way obligated to honor the name change. On the maps that the state produces, the signs that the state has, you know, for example, the signs in Custer State Park on the trails that lead up to Harney Peak, state tourism publications, et cetera, the state doesn't have to change the name in those things if they don't choose to. Still have not heard anything final and definitive from Governor Dennis Dugard, except that that's under consideration. Also, Senator John Thune apparently is mulling options to possibly introduce legislation that would change the renaming process at the federal level, as he says, prevent basically bureaucrats in Washington from making a decision about a place name in South Dakota or another state. So lots of interesting things still kind of in the mix on that that we're trying to watch and to see where it all ends up.
Over 2 years of following this, Seth, what are some of the things that sort of stand out to you politically about this conversation?
Well, there's so many layers to it. I mean, what makes it so fascinating, obviously, is there's history, race, politics. So much of our identity as South Dakotans is wrapped up in this, and then the symbolism of this being the highest point in the state. You know, just layer upon layer of meaning. I guess the biggest thing that stands out to me and it's so fascinating is, as I said, this started with a Lakota elder from Pine Ridge simply writing a letter. That was it. The letter goes to the State Board of Geographic Names and the U.S. Board of Geographic Names. The process plays forward for 2 years, and here we are. And, you know, to some, that shows that one person can still make a difference, obviously, and wield a lot of power. To others, it shows that one person can wield too much power, and the federal government can wield too much power over states. But that's, to me, the big narrative of this story was just one person with an idea, you know, and puts that idea out there and look what's happened.
So we have an idea of where the state is at. Do we going forward, do we have an idea of where others are at, other name changes that are being tossed about, or just other options if the state decides not to honor the name change?
As far as other...
Yeah, are you hearing from the other side, from Bravehart or others that say, well, what if the state doesn't honor this? Or are people starting to say, well, you know, Custer is next? Or, you know, there's other cities that or locations that they feel should be addressed.
Yeah, Basil Bravehart, I mean, he's just hoping that the state will honor this, and he's encouraging the governor to do so. And I think, like, you know, the rest of us just waiting to see if the governor will make any definitive move on it. As far as other name changes, I have asked him about that. He said he's potentially interested in that, but he doesn't really want to get into it right now. So I don't know if there'll be any other name changes proposed. Of course, over in Wyoming, there's been a movement to change the name of Devil's Tower. You know, I would suspect that maybe the people that are proposing that may want to get Basil Bravehart involved in their movement more or you know, learn from him or whatever, and that might be a place where he might end up next. I'm not sure. But yeah, right now I think there's so much uncertainty as far as, you know, the state's position on this. That's what everybody's focusing on for the moment is Harney / Black Elk Peak.
Dana, do you have a perspective on this to add to it from an East River perspective? What are you hearing?
You know, it's been interesting to watch everything that's going on out West River. Obviously, it sort of came as a surprise to our office, too, that those statements started coming out, that the announcement came out that it would be renamed. Obviously, that was a big piece of discussion out in Pier over the legislative session, too, and it didn't really amount to anything. So on our end, we kind of thought the conversation had ended, at least temporarily, and then seemingly out of nowhere, the decision was made. And I know we've had a few columnists and reporters sort of look at it and just identify some of the conflicts that, as Seth mentioned, that are at play there. And I think it's just a really interesting discussion between the feds and the state.
Mm-hmm. We'll have more on that coming forward, too. I think all of us will be watching it. So certainly not the last time we'll have that conversation. And then also let's look forward a little bit to another ongoing conversation, which is the State House in November and the upcoming elections. Dana, you took a good statistical look at how competitive some of those district elections and legislative races will or won't be. You want to give us an update on your work there?
I would love to. So we hear pretty much every day how competitive the election is between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. But something that is being a little bit less covered and that I got curious about was the level of how contested the elections are going to be for the state legislature. So I started looking at some of the information and historical data. Earlier this summer, it was about 1 in 4 seats that were going to be uncontested. Last week, that came down to 1 in 3, and that number is likely to remain, but it's interesting to look at just the huge number of districts that have consistently backed one political party or another. So essentially, those races can be assumed to be taken off the table. That's how the Republican Party operates as far as determining where they're going to focus volunteers and money. So I'll have a story hopefully later today online and on Sunday that looks at where those really competitive races are, the few that the state has left.
And you mentioned that there's other factors that can impact those that would maybe make some shifts. Can you give us an idea of what some of those major factors could be that would make something turn out unexpectedly?
Yeah, so, I mean, obviously this is a political year that the unexpected is happening all around us. There's a definite move to overthrow the establishment, if you will. So while about 90% of the time incumbents are likely to be reelected for their seats, we might not see that this year. I think Seth could speak really well to how that occurred out West River in the primaries, that incumbents aren't as invincible as maybe they have been in the past. So while there are these 6 races that might be sort of the ones to watch, there are definitely others across the state that could be competitive too. The most recent legislative session, I think, gave a lot of people reason to question or rethink who they're voting for and potentially re-engage in state-level politics.
Seth, do you see that where you're at, sort of a people holding their breath for their unexpected or engaging at a higher level than before in local politics?
Yeah, and for us, you know, obviously in the West River region, which is, very predominantly Republican as far as registration numbers, you know, the real competition was mostly in the primaries. And that's not to say there won't be some competition in the general, but there was far more in the primary. And as Dana said, there was a lot of backlash this year against some of the Republican incumbents because of recent actions by the legislature and Governor Dugard to raise the state sales tax and raise taxes and fees on vehicles. And there was kind of a movement out here among some more conservative Republicans to say, let's get rid of some of these incumbents and replace them with people who are more conservative. And so So that made for very, very competitive primaries, but probably not nearly as competitive general election.
You don't expect big surprises going forward into the general election?
No, not out here in the legislative races.
Sure.
Again, you know, anything can happen, but no. I mean, you know, a lot of the races will be uncontested, and the ones that are contested usually pit a Republican against a Democrat in a county with far more Republicans than there are Democrats. So,
Dana, this was on Facebook. You can download the entire spreadsheet and really kind of dig into it. Did you get any feedback from that from readers?
We got a little bit. The indications that we got are that most of those districts that are fairly split at this point are the ones that the parties are looking at. They know that those are the ones that are going to be the real contests. And then I think there are about 22 races where there might be some incumbents in those races, but based on some of their decisions out in Pierre, they could be sort of on the chopping block too, potentially come November.
Seth, I really do want to talk about your Sunday feature about bikers for Trump. I think the headline is Bikers for Trump or Bikers for Personal Profit, because I was out in Sturgis and I noticed, I think what you noticed, which was an incredible amount of Trump gear being sold. And I couldn't tell, I was there before the rally started, I couldn't tell if it was going to be a popular item or if it was just there. You followed up on that. Give me an idea of what you found out.
Yeah, Trump merchandise is very popular out there, and there were multiple locations where it was being sold, both in Sturgis, out at the big campgrounds outside of town. But almost all of those places, they were just people, you know, trying to make a buck, or people saying that they were doing it on behalf of the Trump campaign or whatever. But there was only one that said he was leading a movement, and that was Chris Cox for Bikers for Trump. And when I started researching him, found out that he's popped up in a lot of stories across the country. And seemingly nobody has ever questioned exactly what is Bikers for Trump and where does the money go.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think a lot of people would assume when somebody's talking about leading a political movement that they must be organized probably as a nonprofit or a political action committee or whatever. But in doing the research, I found out that's not the case. Bikers for Trump is has been registered as a limited liability company in Delaware, which is, you know, where people go and to register their corporation when they don't want to pay a lot of taxes. And Chris Cox also took out a trademark on the phrase Bikers for Trump.
Mm-hmm.
And at the rally, when I visited his vendor booth at the Buffalo Chip, even though he says he's leading this movement to get bikers to vote for Trump, he wasn't passing out any formal information about Trump or the election or anything like that. He was just selling T-shirts for $20. So, and turns out the money doesn't go to the Trump campaign. It just goes to him.
Hmm. Did you buy one?
No, I didn't. But so that was interesting, and I just thought, you know, anytime you say you're leading a movement, but yet there's no real accountability or transparency about the flow of money, that's something that probably needs to be scrutinized.
Sure, smart question to ask.
Yeah, so very interesting. But yeah, the biker crowd there, I did also poll a lot of the bikers that I met, and you know, it was probably 90% or more of a Donald Trump crowd.
Mm-hmm. And many from out of town or out of state.
Right, yeah.
Right, and, from that point, yeah.
Many from out of state, but some from in-state as well that I met that were strongly
pro-Trump. Did you ask them what issues, you know, that made them want, not so much Trump as a person, because we hear a lot about that, but what did you dig into sort of what they cared about as issues?
Yeah, I did, and a lot of people brought up Second Amendment issues and a fear that Hillary Clinton would be too much of an anti-gun rights candidate. Other than that, I think it was more of an identification of a group of people who, you know, as we all know, the Sturgis bike rally is not politically correct, and there's a lot of interesting, colorful people there, and I think a lot of them see a kindred spirit, so to speak, in Donald Trump, who, you know, the kinds of things he says are the kinds of things you hear at the biker rally, and it kind of emboldens them to say those the kinds of things he says in polite company, where maybe it would have been limited to the rally before. So there's a really interesting parallel there, I think, maybe they feel that, like I said, there's kind of a kindred spirit and a chance to vote for somebody like that.
Dana, do you want to weigh in on Dennis Dugard, governor of South Dakota, and his new relationship with the Donald Trump campaign as far as agriculture is concerned?
Yeah, so we learned yesterday that Donald Trump has named Dugard to his new agriculture advisory committee, and that was sort of an interesting development after Dugard didn't vote for Trump in the state's Republican primary and was pretty open about talking about how he voted for Governor Kasich rather than Trump. So apparently they've mended whatever sort of disagreement they had before. Trump is willing to sort of forgive and forget, though that's not always his character, and said, you know what, you can be on this advisory committee. Dugard seems excited to be able to influence policy as far as that is concerned. And I thought it was interesting, too. There was no real word from Dugard's office on whether that sort of constituted an endorsement of Trump, which we haven't really seen any sort of endorsement from the governor of the Republican nominee beyond him saying, you know, I think that Mike Pence, the governor of Indiana, is a good choice for him as far as a potential VP. So something interesting to watch and definitely interesting to put South Dakota on the map.
Seth, any final words on maybe some input on ag policy in the Republican platform coming up?
Yeah, I see it as I think a lot of people see it, which is Republicans like Dennis Dugard just saying, well, you know, if we're stuck with this guy, maybe we can at least get him under control a little bit and influence his policy.
Bend his ear and see if he's willing to
right.
listen. Certainly
yeah,
he would not.
Certainly he's on the bandwagon or anything, but maybe trying to have some influence. So.
Absolutely. Seth Tupper, Enterprise reporter at the Rapid City Journal. Seth, thanks for being here today.
You bet.
Dana Ferguson, Watchdog State Government political reporter, Argus Leader. Dana, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.